You're listening to The Globalist, first brobroadcast on the 21st of March 2024 on Molecule Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1600 in Bangkok, 8am in Brussels, 7am here at Midori House in London, and 3am in Ottawa. You're listening to Molecule Radio. The Globalist starts now. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the leaders of the EU meet with the agenda as full and as serious as ever. Will the session be a chance to iron out differences within the bloc? We'll find out. Also coming up, the president of Vietnam resigns, or was he pushed? We'll examine what happens next in a country where foreign investors are banking on the nation's stability. And Monocle's US politics correspondent will explore the role of disinformation in this year's presidential elections.
But it's really important to realize that some of the most persistent and pernicious forms of online disinformation in the United States and elsewhere were text-based.
Plus, the paper review will come from Paris today and will delve into the latest edition of Monocle magazine. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Russia has launched a missile attack on the Ukrainian capital Kyiv, injuring at least 10 people. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told US Republican senators that Israel will continue its efforts to defeat Hamas. And the US National Security Advisor has promised that a major aid package, blocked by Republicans for months, will get to Ukraine. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the 27 leaders of the EU meet today with defence, the Middle East and the continuing protests by the bloc's agricultural sectors on the agenda. Plus, they're expected to give the political green light to the opening of accession talks with Bosnia and Herzegovina. So to go through an enormously large agenda, I'm joined now by Suzanne Lynch, who's Global Playbook author and associate editor at Politico in Brussels. Welcome back, Suzanne. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Right, this is a high-stakes summit, isn't it?
It very much is. Leaders will be arriving here around lunchtime, and there's a two-day meeting, very much focusing particularly on those issues, as you said, but defence is a big topic. In his letter, two leaders before the summit, Charles Michel, the head of the European Council, talked about Europe needing to be on a wartime footing, to put the EU's economy on a war footing, he said, and talked about how the fact that the continent was facing the biggest security threat since the Second World War. So trying to get some agreement on that, on how, where the EU needs to go from here.
We are. So let's focus on this one, and then we'll move on to the other really big subjects that need to be tackled as well today. But when it comes to Ukraine, we are now, what, more than 2 years in, and the defence talks are still talking about the way that the European Union supports Ukraine, how it can come together, how various countries' approaches must be ironed out, because there are hugely differing ones now at the moment. I mean, one suggests that after 2.5 years, these should have been sorted out by now, surely.
Yeah, so the EU has struggled on this issue as a collective. So individually, you've seen a lot of change among different countries. So in Germany is now providing a huge amount of aid to Ukraine, for example, military aid, which was a complete turnaround for Germany. But what they have struggled to do is try and have a more EU-wide response to this that would, save money, be more effective, make more sense. So, for example, an example of this would be during COVID, when the EU got together and was able to procure vaccines together, it made more sense. That was one example of it. And that's the kind of idea people are trying to do here now about defence, that rather than having this patchwork across Europe with different countries providing this and that at two different levels, there'd be some kind of more common approach that they would fund or help Ukraine as a collective. It's a big market, obviously, the EU, and it would work better that way. So what they're looking at is quite a finance focus, you know, how to finance that, for example. So one idea is that President Macron has been very strong on this in the last few days and said that the EU should issue bonds, war bonds, defense bonds to try and finance this. But some countries, not least Germany, are opposed to this. So that's one example of the idea that's going to be discussed today.
Tell us a little bit more about how the plates are shifting within the European Union here, because we've seen in the last few months at least Poland being welcomed back into the fold with the return of Donald Tusk to be Prime Minister, a key figure now, a uniting figure, many would suggest. Yet at the same time, we have Hungary and now Slovakia causing more problems for the European Union in terms of their push towards Russia.
Yes, and I think Hungary, that is going to be a fly in the ointment today, for example. Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, he is obviously he rails against various EU measures. But on Ukraine, he's a very strong view. He feels that the EU shouldn't really go any further, keep giving what it's giving, but that it shouldn't get more involved in anything that would provoke Russia. And Slovakia, there's quite a right-wing leader there, Fico as well, is backing that. So he, you know, with these big issues, you can have one country that blocks something. So it's important to have everyone on board. In saying that, he's not alone. I mean, some of these issues, one other proposal, for example, is that the European Investment Bank should be used to fund defence. A lot of countries are against that in principle. My own home country, Ireland, for example, it's a shareholder in the EIB. It would be completely ideologically against that. That should not be the role of the European Investment Bank to fund arms and defence that would then go to Ukraine, because Ireland is a military neutral country. So you've got all these problems that maybe for different reasons, some countries don't want to get more involved in defence. But you're absolutely right in that the presence of Donald Tusk, he's very much seen as an adult in the room by a lot of leaders here, even though he himself has come under a huge pressure from his own farming lobby and has bowed to that to an extent. A lot of the farmers in Poland are not happy with the imports that are coming in from Ukraine. They're obviously bordering the country there in the east of the bloc.
Will there be any consideration of Emmanuel Macron's comments from last week when he talked about the reality that one day that Western troops could end up in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think there will be. I think there will be some of that. Ukraine's Prime Minister Volodymyr Zelensky is due to address leaders here this afternoon by video link. So no doubt he will make the case for the urgency of this. And obviously, as we know, Ukraine is still waiting for the stalled aid from the US Congress. So they badly need this. So I think there have been reports that some German reports and research, German intelligence services reportedly warned that an attack on an EU country could happen as soon as 2026. So I do think that is going to be very high on the agenda. In saying that, to be perfectly honest, there are some people here in Brussels who would be suspicious that when France talks about increasing the European defence industry, it's talking about its own defence industry, because France, of course, is one of the big defence producers. So the argument would be, of course, it wants more EU defence, because most of its companies are heavily, one of the big drivers of that. I think Macron is going to be a big voice on this when he arrives here today.
What about the non-military measures that the European Union can take? I mean, it is since the 27 last met, two things have happened. Firstly, Alexei Navalny died in a penal colony in the Arctic. And secondly, President Vladimir Putin was elected, in inverted commas, many argue, for another 5 years in power. Tell us a little bit more about what the European Union is considering doing or can do to try to address these two events.
Yes, absolutely. So earlier in the week, EU foreign ministers met here, and that usually happens in advance of the EU summit. And they did agree, or they did signal, that they were going to impose new sanctions over the death of Navalny. And this would be sanctions on 30 Russian officials, individuals, on this. So that now has to be rubber stamped. And we're waiting to hear some more of the details on that. But there was broad political agreement for that. We do expect, obviously, then a denunciation of the election in Russia. Although, of course, not all countries, have the same view. You mentioned Hungary and Viktor Orban. Orban has met Vladimir Putin, for example, one of the only EU leaders who have done so since the start of the war. So sometimes it depends who you're asking. And most countries in Europe, of course, have denounced the election as a sham. But yes, I think this has made people realize that this, you know, Putin is not going anywhere, that he has been invigorated by this election, that we all knew he was going to win it. Obviously, it was a sham election. But for him, the optics were important. So there has been a lot of speculation here that after the election, Putin would send a lot more, you know, flood troops to Ukraine. Both sides need more troops on the front line, but that he was waiting until after the election. So if that is to happen, that's, of course, going to put huge pressure on Ukraine as it fights back Russia.
One of the big issues that will be raised today is EU enlargement. And there has been an assessment of what the bloc needs to do to be ready for enlargement by 2030, with the idea that Bosnia-Herzegovina should now be allowed to engage in accession talks. But there are calls for changes within the EU to be made before it gets any bigger.
Yes, exactly. So we do expect that decision on Bosnia-Herzegovina to be made today, which is a development. But the big political problem for the EU is that it has agreed to open the door to talks to Ukraine and Moldova. It did so a while ago. But the reality is that the European elections are looming. We've got a lot of protests, for example, by farmers about a potential Ukraine accession because of their huge role as an agriculture producer and how that would affect the agriculture market. So I think a lot of countries in reality want to put this off. They don't want to talk about it before the European election. They want to get the election done and then turn seriously to enlargement. Now, in saying that, Ukraine, which is obviously the most important country in that of its size, as well as the fact that it's at war, is on the track. You know, we've got there are discussions going on all the time between Brussels and Kiev, where they are meeting certain criteria that have to be met before they would accede to the next stage in the process. So that is happening, but it's more about that the EU, you know, let's look at the EU itself, how it works. For example, you know, should this idea that I mentioned, unanimity, that you need everyone to agree on certain issues, that should that be looked at in terms of foreign policy? Maybe that needs to be changed because there's a fear that everything will become too unwieldy if more join. And all these discussions we were talking about earlier about, you know, common issues of debt and those kind of things, they're all internal reform things that some people feel should happen before we even get to the stage where people, other countries, would join. So it's a huge issue, enlargement. At the end of the day, if Ukraine joins the EU, it's a very big country. So Kiev would wield huge influence, say, in the European Parliament and in the Council of the EU, and would also be a major player when it comes to agriculture, which would very much influence and change the dynamics within the EU.
Suzanne Lynch, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Now, Vietnam's politics took a rather unsteady turn yesterday with the resignation of the country's president. In power for little over a year, Va Van Thung's departure follows the arrest of a former official on corruption charges. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by James Chambers, who's Monocle's Asia editor. He's based in Bangkok. A very good afternoon to you, James.
Morning, Emma.
So Va Van Thung's departure follows accusations of shortcomings. What are shortcomings in Vietnamese politics?
I think the first thing, and perhaps the most important thing to understand about Vietnamese politics, and it's very similar to Chinese politics, is that there are kind of two layers to politics. There's the party, the Communist Party, it sits at the top, and there's the government. So Va Van Thung was the president. So he was the top figure in the government, but actually the party is the most important thing. So the most senior leader in Vietnam is the General Secretary of the Communist Party, and he remains in place. So when we talk about the president resigning, it is a senior role, but it is not the top guy. And so he was, it's been reported as if he resigned yesterday, but obviously he was forced to vacate his position. And the reason that's been given at the moment is that he violated party rules. So that's a reference to the Communist Party and nothing, no reference to any law that he may have broken. So whatever he's done, we don't know what it is, but it has been a violation of party rules, and he's essentially damaged the reputation of the Communist Party.
So this resignation, this stepping back, tell us a little bit more about the idea of whether he jumped or whether he was pushed.
Well, he was certainly pushed. There's no question about that. And even though we don't know the exact reasons for it, it's all part of this ongoing and huge anti-corruption initiative that's been raging in Vietnam for years, actually. It started in 2016, but it's only in the last few years that it's really kind of ratcheted up. And we've seen some big figures get taken down by this. You know, the guy, the president who resigned yesterday, he was only in the job for a little over a year, and he replaced his predecessor, who had also had to leave because of graft. I guess what makes this particular resignation interesting is that there's an understanding that he was handpicked by the general secretary, by Nguyen Phu Thong, which is the guy who really does call the shots in Vietnam. He is the equivalent of Xi Jinping in China. So he was, you know, the president was the general secretary's man, and he was being seen as a future star, someone who might actually rise to the most senior ranks. So the fact that he has been taken down by this suggests that there's a lot of kind of factional infighting in the Communist Party. And as you said at the start, this is all gives this image of instability and chaos, which is not what these authoritarian countries are known for.
Tell us what this long-term issue with corruption is in Vietnam. I think you mentioned, you know, the number of people who've been arrested in the last couple of years. It's hundreds of government officials, high-ranking politicians. You say what? Thong is the second Vietnamese president to go in 14 months.
It's something that's, you know, straddles politics and business. I mean, those two things go hand in hand. All the kind of bribery and corruption in politics often involves, you know, issuing licenses and certificates for business people. And right now, you know, Vietnam is seeing perhaps its biggest corruption case go through the courts at the moment, involving a very, very successful and wealthy businesswoman in Ho Chi Minh City. She's being accused of a $12 billion fraud. And that case has, you know, completely frozen everything in Vietnam's major commercial hub. Because while this is going on, while this corruption case is going on, all the junior officials in that city are just too scared to do anything. So they're not issuing any kinds of certificates in case they get accused of being involved in bribery. And this lady is, you know, we found out this week the prosecutors want to hand her the death penalty. So, you know, it's a huge thing that goes right across the country. As I said, it's years in the making. And the first point to make is that it is important that Vietnam addresses its problems with corruption. Every country has corruption, but in my years of being in Asia, you know, Vietnam is always the one that comes top of the list in terms of the country that has the worst corruption in this part of the world. So the government does need to tackle it. And a bit like what they were doing in China, it was addressing something they needed to do. The problem they're facing is that, you know, when does an anti-corruption initiative turn into kind of political score settling? The leader, the general secretary in Vietnam, is, you know, following a similar playbook to Xi Jinping, and he's consolidating power in his hands. And there have been accusations that he's using anti-corruption as a way of, you know, taking down rivals, that he can become the most powerful person in the country. So while it is needed, and Vietnam does need to clean up, especially as more and more foreign investors are pouring into the country, there are doubts about how sincere some of these cases actually are.
Tell us a little bit more about this international position that Vietnam is enjoying at the moment, because as the world is noticing that Washington and Beijing's tensions are causing many manufacturers to move away from China, many Western manufacturers, Vietnam seems to be their chosen new destination. So when you have this amount of instability, what does that do?
That's right. I guess a lot of companies are pursuing this China plus one policy. So they might not be able to completely withdraw from China, but they need to have a plan B. And Vietnam is seen as the next best option. It is very similar to China in many ways. I think if I ran a multinational, I would be setting up shop in Vietnam. But this political instability will be a cause for concern. Companies like Samsung, they have a massive manufacturing hub in the north of the country. They make over half their smartphones in Vietnam. And the reason why they've been there for years is because, it's very stable. You can say what you will about these Communist Party, one party states, but they have their 5-year plans. They tell you how fast the economy is going to grow, and they normally hit those numbers. And the transfer of power is normally quite orderly. So this will be give foreign investors pause for thought, because it is not why they invest so heavily in these places. They expect stability. But what I would say, it's probably a more of a short term concern. I think everyone's quite bullish on Vietnam's long-term potential, especially as all the investment does move from China to Vietnam. But the government really does need to sort its act out, because right now they have the current problem with the president resigning, but there's a bigger problem not too far in the future with the general secretary, because it's well known that he's not in very good health. He took the decision in a similar way to Mr. Xi in China to stay on for an unprecedented third term. So as he's consolidated his power, and now there's no obvious replacements for him, what's going to happen when he departs? That could be, Vietnam could be in for even more instability and much more wide-ranging than this resignation.
James Chambers in Bangkok, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme, we look at the role of disinformation in the upcoming US elections.
But it's really important to realise that some of the most persistent and pernicious forms of online disinformation in the United States and elsewhere were text-based.
Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue with today's newspapers. Joining me on the line from Paris is Agnès Poirier, who's journalist and author of Notre Dame, the Soul of France. A very good morning to you, Agnès.
Good morning.
How's Paris looking?
Oh, it looks gorgeous this morning. Well, it's spring today, and it really feels like spring. And if I were you, I would hop on the Eurostar and just come and have coffee, because I'm told that temperatures are going to drop by 10 degrees this weekend. So today's the day.
OK, I shall cancel all my plans and head straight to London St. Pancras Station. Thank you for that. While I dream of that and fail, just tell us a little bit more about what's in the papers this week.
Well, today's Thursday, and this is when L'Express publishes its weekly issue. L'Express is a French weekly magazine, and it has a very interesting issue today. It looks at how October the 7th and the Hamas attacks on Israel and the subsequent Israeli retaliation against Gaza is changing our perception of the world we live in. And it opens with a very long and very, I thought, fascinating, remarkable interview with Gilles Kepel. So you may know Gilles Kepel is this French scholar of the Arab world and the Middle East, and he's just published an essay trying to make sense of the last 6 months. And it is called Holocaust, but Holocausts with an S. And so he analyzes the cycle of violence that October the 7th has created in the region on both sides. And for him, it's proving to be a major geopolitical shock, that's his terms, and it feeds a discourse on the global South against the North, considered as colonial, a discourse which has reached, as we've seen, our universities in the West, whether in Harvard or in Sciences Po in Paris just last week. And so he explains that if you want to understand what's going on there, you need to understand that Holocaust means a massacre of religion origin, and that the mystical and the political are closely intertwined. So Palestine is identified as belonging to the South, and Israel and its historical allies as the North. And for him, it goes extremely deep, because he says the post-war international order of 1945, that was based on an alliance between the USSR, the US, Britain, and France on the never again, which even the Cold War did not change. You know, that moral assumption that the Holocaust and a world war should never take place again has now been broken. That international order has been broken. And one of the many examples that he gives is that, for instance, South Africa accusing Israel of genocide. It's this attempt to break the semantics that we've known since 1945. But of course, you know, if you look in detail at the South, the global South, there's in fact little in common between, let's say, India and China, Egypt and Ethiopia, for instance. And he compares September the 11th and October the 7th. In each case, he says Israel and the US looked far more vulnerable than they thought to be. And of course, he goes on talking about the Faustian Pact of Benjamin Netanyahu, who released the chief of Hamas, who is responsible for October the 7th, back in 2011. And by sort of preferring to have two Palestinians, one under the helm of the Palestinian Authority and the other under the helm of Hamas, Netanyahu completely stopped the Oslo peace process. And it goes on. And what is great with Gilles Kepel, it's always extremely nuanced, very complex. It gives the facts. And in the end, you know, you feel you know a bit better, but you also know it's going to be extremely difficult to make sense of it all and to come out of it.
It is a must read. It's incredibly nuanced and it is incredibly detailed. And there will be passages in it which will be found to be highly offensive to lots and lots of people. I mean, how do you think this is going to be received in France?
Well, I mean, Gilles Kepel is, you know, has taught in every university, you know, in America, in France. He's extremely well regarded. That's his field, you know, for the last 40 years. He obviously speaks Arabic. He knows all those regions intimately well. And, you know, facts are often offensive to ideologues, but he's the opposite of an ideologue. You know, he introduces complexity and nuance in debates that are too often hijacked by people with very short-sighted and very simplistic approaches. So he introduces intelligence, complexity, and that's so much welcome.
Let's move on to a story which is slightly less complex and slightly less nuanced, but is a story of principle, isn't it? During COVID, many governments gave lots of individuals and companies lots of money to help them through. One of the repercussions of it is that there's been quite a lot of fraud. And while some countries are finding it quite hard to chase those who decided that they would make a little bit of hay while the sun shone in their view, the French authorities are clamping down on the fraudsters.
Well, yes. I mean, it's fascinating. You know, at the moment, France is trying to save 10 billion euros in all its, you know, in public spending. I mean, France has a very generous welfare system. But on the other hand, of course, they don't want to be seen as raising taxes. They don't want to raise taxes. So they think, well, the system being so generous, let's chase the fraudsters, the swindlers, everyone who, you know, tries to take advantage of our system. And they've been incredibly successful. It started, you know, they only started with a few, one or two regions in the south of France 5 years ago. And their main aim was to find out all the owners who had not declared their swimming pool. And of course, you need to pay a little tax if you have a swimming pool. And it's been so successful that last year they extended their survey to the whole of France. And it's interesting how they did it, because they only used publicly available data with you know, pictures taken by plane. And also they added a bit of artificial intelligence, some software that were devised specially. And of course, they hired a few hundreds inland revenue inspectors just to roam the streets of villages and to take pictures as well. And you know what? They found 140,000 swimming pools that were not declared to the fiscal authorities. So that means that they managed to collect 15.2 billion euros of unpaid taxes. And they said they were not going to stop here because it's been so successful. Now they are going to use exactly the same system, a bit of artificial intelligence, some inspectors on the ground and some aerial pictures to find if you've built an extension to your house or a conservatory or perhaps a garden shed, because you need to pay taxes also for those. So expect some bonanza next year.
And some very expensive sheds and some very expensive swimming pools. Agnès Parrier, thank you as ever for joining us on the line from Paris. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, live on Monocle Radio. The time here in London is 7:31. Time for a quick look at the rest of today's headlines. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told US Republican senators that Israel will continue its efforts to defeat Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Mr. Netanyahu spoke to Republicans via video link nearly a week after the Senate's Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he was an obstacle to peace and should stand aside. Russia has launched a missile attack on the Ukrainian capital Kyiv, injuring at least 10 people. Officials say the attack damaged residential buildings and industrial facilities. It's the first large assault on the city for several weeks. And the Netherlands is to provide Ukraine with 350 million euros to spend on F-16 fighter jet ammunition and advanced reconnaissance drones. The Dutch Defence Minister, Kaiser Ollengren, said she'd come to Kiev to show solidarity and to announce the new aid package. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Nudging 7:33 here in London. Now, Canada is to halt all arms shipments to Israel. It's the first major Western ally to do so. The Israeli government has strongly condemned the decision, its foreign minister saying that it undermines a country's right to defend itself. Well, joining me now in the studio is Europe correspondent for the Globe and Mail, Paul Waldie, a regular around the Monocle radio desk. A very good morning to you, Paul.
Hi there.
Good to have you with us. So this halting of all arms shipments, it follows a non-binding vote in the Canadian Parliament, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the question is it halting all arms shipments? I mean, that's how ridiculous the situation has gotten. Here we are Thursday, this vote was on Monday, and nobody still really quite knows in Canada what this actually means. The motion itself called for no further arms sales. The NDP, the party that proposed the motion, says that means there's not going to be any more arms sales, everything's halted, we won. The Liberal government, on the other hand, is saying not quite. We have stopped the permits, issuing permits for arms sales in January, so there'll be no further ones after January. The ones issued before are in place, so it doesn't really mean we're stopping everything full square. So everybody's confused over what this means. The Liberal Party's turning itself upside down about this. And Canadians really don't know where the country stands on this whole
and
issue.
And indeed, the context is that there actually haven't been any arms exports since January, have they? And in fact, even going back a little bit further, Canada has only been shipping non-lethal equipment to Israel since October, haven't they? For example, they are only sending comms equipment. They're not sending anything more dangerous.
Yeah, I think we have to keep this in perspective. Canada is not a huge arms supplier to anyone, but Canada does supply components to different things, whether they're lethal or non-lethal. And I think that's one of the issues here. Prior to January, there were permits issued for those kinds of things. And those permits technically are still in place. So if a company who was supplying those types of things before January continued to do so, they'd be allowed to do that. What this motion, which again was non-binding, and the government doesn't have to follow it, but they say they will, means that no further permits will be issued for those kinds of things for the time being. And I think that's a key phrase that the government's trying to get out. The NDP is saying, no, this stops it for good. And the Liberals are saying, not quite. So, you know, again, we're back to the position where it's still really unclear what the government's going to do.
Well, while we wade through this morass of what means what, when and how, there's a bigger question here, isn't there, which is the internal struggles and the internal accusations that Justin Trudeau and his government aren't doing enough here to take a stand against Israel.
Yeah, and I think you have to look at the political context here. Trudeau has a minority government. His government is supported by the NDP, the New Democrats. They're kind of like the Labour Party in Britain. That would be a similar kind of equation. They've been propping up the Liberal government. They've pledged to do that until next year at the earliest, where there's probably going to be an election. So the Liberals have to kind of listen to what the NDP says if they want to stay in power. So the NDP has been pushing a pretty hard line on Gaza, on the Palestinians, and calling for ceasefires and these kinds of things. And this motion was part of that. So the Liberals are kind of finding themselves in a bit of a quandary here because, yes, they need the NDP support, but they also have quite a support base amongst Jewish Canadians that they have to be mindful of. And some of their own caucus members voted against this motion. So they're divided over this. And I think they're trying to tread some kind of fine line here where they can please both people who are pro-Palestinian and the Jewish community. And that's not really working very well.
Indeed, because the Israeli foreign minister has, as I mentioned a moment ago, saying that, you know, this decision by Canada, despite the comparatively small amount of arms that are sent by Canada to Israel, the principles are that this is undermining Israel's right to self-defense. Now, how does that play out domestically in Canada?
Well, there's a lot of ramifications for this. First of all, on the one hand, Canada might not be a big player in the arms trade, but it does send a signal to other countries that might want to follow suit. Canada does have that kind of clout internationally. Secondly, one of the major problems is the immigration minister, Mark Miller, got up in the House of Commons and said that this could really impact the ability for Canada to get Canadian citizens in the Gaza Strip out, because Israel kind of controls that process. Canada has about 1,000 people who've applied to come to the country under a permit system. None of them have gotten out. And the immigration minister says this motion now could make that even more difficult, because Israel obviously is very well aware of what Canada has done here. So there's going to be some real ramifications. There are families in Canada that are quite concerned that their relatives might not get out because of this motion.
So what happens next? I mean, in the foreseeable future, you mentioned that, you know, the immediate difficulty of getting Canadian families out of Gaza. But in terms of the way that Canada positions itself within the global narrative here, where does it want to go?
Well, and that's the big question. And I think that's the question Trudeau has to try and address here. What is Canada really saying? Is Canada saying it's going to pursue an arms embargo on Israel and wants other countries to join in? Is it saying, no, this is a temporary measure, this is something we're just thinking about? Is Canada going to take a harder line on a ceasefire? Canada did vote at the United Nations in December for a ceasefire, but then they sort of cautioned that said, no, that was only a humanitarian ceasefire, kind of changed the language a little bit. So the inconsistencies are piling up, and Trudeau's going to have to really start to articulate clearly where Canada stands on all of these issues.
And how much faith is there in Justin Trudeau being able to navigate this, both domestically and internationally?
Well, not a lot domestically. He's far behind in the opinion polls. As I mentioned, election maybe next year. The Conservative Party and their new leader, Pierre Poilievre, is quite far ahead. He's pursuing a lot of other issues. This is not a big issue for the Conservative Party. They did vote against this motion, and they have become much more attractive to a lot of Jewish voters in recent years because the former leader and former prime minister, Stephen Harper, was very, very pro-Israel. So they're staying out of this fray to many respects. They voted against the motion. It's not a big topic of conversation for them, but they have been pursuing domestic issues that have put them quite far ahead. And I think Trudeau's going to have to find his footing somewhere if he's hoping to avoid a massive defeat next year.
And indeed, but also you've got the idea that further south there will be, the key U.S. elections coming up. I mean, how much is that factoring into the decision processes here?
It does factor into the process in Canada a fair bit. I mean, Canada now has broken with the U.S., more or less with the Biden administration anyway, and a lot of these U.N. votes and a lot of the positioning, taking a slightly more pro-Palestinian side than certainly Biden has. And of course, Biden is coming under pressure from a lot of his Democratic voters as well, very similar to the issues Trudeau's facing. I think, yes, the U.S. weighs in Canada much more domestic in terms of economic issues and trade issues, not so much foreign policy issues, because Canada tends to be pretty much lockstep with the U.S. anyway. So this is a little bit of a divergence, but I don't think that's going to matter too much to Canadian voters. It's going to be much more domestic issues. But nonetheless, this kind of reinforces the image amongst a lot of people that Trudeau just can't make up his mind and can't make a decision and can't be a strong leader on the world stage.
Paul Waldie, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. . 2024 has been dubbed the year of the election, with billions around the world expected to be heading to the polls this year. But in the age of AI and online conspiracy theories, how does one win elections amid so much disinformation? Well, author and Monocle's US politics correspondent Sasha Eisenberg has written a new book dealing with this exact issue. And he sat down with Monocle's US editor Chris Law to talk about the lie detectives and how disinformation is already making itself felt in the run-up to November.
So I think everybody is on the lookout for how will the technological capabilities change the nature of disinformation this year. That could be the quantity of it. That could be the speed of disseminating, the scale, the scope. What's the role that AI is going to play, and particularly the new sophistication of deepfake video and audio. And we're seeing examples of this already. On the day of the New Hampshire primary, there was a fake Joe Biden who was recorded in an automated robocall going to New Hampshire voters saying, hey, the primary day has changed. Don't turn out and vote on Tuesday. It was a pretty good example of what somebody can do with, off-the-shelf tools. But it's really important to realize that some of the most persistent and pernicious forms of online disinformation in the United States and elsewhere were text-based. The QAnon conspiracy in the United States, Donald Trump's election denial, which is not just a particular piece of online disinformation, but has become a sort of complete conspiracy theory that shapes how believers see basically every force in U.S. life. These were things that were not supported by persuasive fake videos. These were created by what is a pretty old school way of getting people to believe in conspiracy theories, which is you start telling them a story that they want to believe and have it accord just enough with reality and just enough with sort of playing to their inclinations and instincts, and they start to buy it, which is why we've had conspiracy theories in the world for centuries.
The character that emerges at the center of the book is called Jory Craig, and in a way, she is a political consultant, but she's being hired by campaigns all over the world to combat these disinformationists, if you will, and certainly ultimately she ends up doing it here in the United States. Tell me a bit about Jory Craig and sort of what she represents, if you like, in this battle against disinformation.
What happened after November 2016 was that this woman, who had never before worked on a domestic American political campaign, she's from Illinois, but she had never worked in American politics, starts getting phone calls from people in Washington, in prominent positions in the Democratic Party, at labor unions, tied to donors, who are saying, hey, we're trying to make sense of what just happened in this election. were learning that there were these troll armies and bot farms that were attacking Hillary Clinton. This was all totally foreign to people in American politics. They knew a hell of a lot about every voter in the United States. They had all these ways of experimenting to measure what was effective and predict what would move certain voters. And now these political professionals in the wake of the 2016 election were having to confront the reality that there were all sorts of political communicators who had the ability to reach American voters and potentially sway them, whose objectives were not always clear. Some of the people who were engaging in, who were creating fake accounts on Facebook to spread news were not doing because they wanted to elect Donald Trump. They wanted to make money off of Facebook ad revenue. They wanted to have fun or create mischief. And Jory Craig became the person who explained to them how to think about all this. And that was because in these countries where she had worked on four or five different continents, a lot of the things that were new to American politicos were old hat, unremarkable.
People didn't necessarily call them disinformation, but, you know,
here in America and in the West, were we a little bit naive to this, really? We were sort of attached to an old, safe world where that didn't happen.
Yes, and, you know, some of that is distinctive to the U.S., I think, in that so much of the American political model was tied up in the, we raise lots of money and we communicate over centralized channels, and the campaign is being run foremost by these sort of centralized political communicators. That model was disintegrating in 2016 in the U.S. And it was the fact that Jory Craig had worked in places where those things were entirely unremarkable, made her this incredibly valuable guide to thinking about the practical questions that faced American political communicators. So she became the person that, you know, the first real counter disinformation operative in American politics, and has done more than anyone to shape the way that at least the Democratic Party and it and the American left think about some of these problems.
Your book is subtitled as a
playbook, a way of thinking about how to counter disinformation, how to
tackle it in this world of politics. Ironically, you know, Jory's sort of one of her main things that she ends up telling a lot of these politicos that you say she's sat down with is do nothing.
The worst case scenario is that you end up amplifying or promoting it. The algorithms that disseminate and promote content online respond to engagement. Most of the examples we see, and that frankly are often surfaced now by kind of disinformation reporters in the media who are incentivized to find the most outrageous things that are circulating somewhere online and surface them, are finding things that are being followed by improbably small audiences. And so the challenge that people like Jory Craig have is convincing decision makers in campaigns, this could be elected officials, candidates, how to distinguish between the stuff that's just a nuisance and the stuff that's a real problem. In the U.S. this year, I think the most underappreciated frontier in disinformation is there's increasing use of apps like WhatsApp, especially among immigrant communities in the U.S., Asian American, Latino immigrant communities. Getting visibility into them from campaigns and political communicators is really difficult. The challenge is that a lot of the institutions which once mediated truth, certainly in the United States, but I think versions of this are true in throughout the world, are weaker than they were. The deep disinformation problem that we face is, why are people so willing to accept lies online and focus more on who's welcoming them than who's putting them out?
That was Sasha Eisenberg there in conversation with Monocle's Chris Lord. And Sasha's book, The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age, is out now. You're with The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
. 11:48 in Dubai, 8:48 a.m. in Zurich. It's time to get a Gulf News Roundup. Mustafa Al-Rawi is journalist and writer based in the UAE. Very good morning to you, Mustafa.
Good morning. How are you? And happy Mother's Day.
Thank you very much indeed. I shall take that with me. Thank you. Right. Let's talk about Saudi Arabia and an enormous announcement yesterday about the amount of money that it's ploughing into artificial intelligence.
That's right. So there was a report that Saudi Arabia and a Silicon Valley venture capital fund called Andreessen Horowitz were working together to create a $40 billion fund to invest in artificial intelligence. It'll likely be the public investment fund, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, that will be working on this. And it really follows a trend in this region and perhaps around the world, that the real urgent area in which money needs to be ploughed into right now is in AI.
And what will it do with this? I mean, it's estimated that the investment into AI from the Saudis is going to be $40 billion. Where will that go?
So if we don't have a lot of color yet on exactly where it will go, but if it's kind of in line with sort of the recent conversations that have happened. For example, we had Jensen Huang from NVIDIA in the region saying, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia, like the UAE, need to be investing in their chips to power AI, of course. Otherwise, if they don't have that infrastructure, they're not going to be able to create the AI-backed applications and technology and equipment that's needed to be at the forefront of this technology. And they shouldn't be reliant on other countries as well. The second part of it would be not just infrastructure like chips and cloud software systems and storage, data storage, but also on investing in companies that could be at the forefront of AI as well.
Let's move on to another big issue for Saudi at the moment. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in the region trying to garner support for a post-war peace plan in Gaza. How is that being received?
There's quite a few different elements at play at the moment. So as you said, Antony Blinken's in the region. He was talking to his Saudi counterpart yesterday evening about getting backing for a US-led ceasefire resolution of the United Nations. We haven't been able to get to one up till now, largely because the US has been vetoing them. But there is some kind of push here because, as Antony Blinken said himself this week, this is the first time in history that an entire population is being classified as being on the brink of starvation. There's, you know, 2 million people in Gaza that are at risk. The humanitarian requirements are massive. And if there isn't a concerted effort by all the nations in the Gulf, the US, elsewhere, to really deal with this, we could be seeing something quite horrific that we've never seen before.
Finally, let's move on to it's Iranian New Year today, but it's much more important than that, isn't it?
It's really big for the Iranian community. There's a large Iranian community in the UAE, particularly in Dubai, but also in Iran next door as well. It's a big celebration, but around the world. And this is kind of a very unique celebration to Iranians. And this is a very, very important time of the year to celebrate their new year. It's a very old tradition as well. And as I mentioned at the beginning, it coincides with it also being Arabic or Middle Eastern Mother's Day as well. So double reasons to celebrate, but a very significant cultural moment for Iranians here and around the world.
Mustafa Al-Rawi, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, on today's programme, a look into the future of hospitality and style. And that's coming from our very own magazine, because the April issue of Monocle Magazine, is finally out today. Monocle's editor, Josh Fennett, sat down with Andrew Muller to talk about it. And this is what they had to say.
Josh, you have right there the April 2024 edition of Monocle magazine. I know that there is a long answer to the question of what's in it, but is there a broad theme to which the issue was attempting to conform?
I was really hoping you'd ask me, quickly tell me what's in it. And I was going to give you a single word phrase, Andrew.
Which was what?
You.
Well, I am. Yeah, I am. I am in there a bit.
Well, I can see you talking to this.
Oh, there's literally a picture of me.
There's literally a picture of you on the contents page. And what are you doing, Andrew? You're interviewing Kyriakos Mitsotakis.
I am. I am interviewing the Prime Minister of Greece. That took place at the Munich Security Conference recently. People may already have heard some of that on The Globalist, but I think we printed the full whack, didn't we?
We did, and it's a very, very punchy interview. And normally we're so combative on Monocle Radio. But let me congratulate you on this.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I think the interesting thing about this and about this issue is we went for a dual theme, which we don't often do with the magazine, because everything we cover in Monocle, from global affairs to business, culture, design, it can't always fit on a neat narrative arc. But we like the idea of hospitality in a world where so much is geared towards efficiency, where so much communication is done online. That little extra step, that little extra bit of effort that goes into a warm greeting, whether you are a prime minister or whether you are running a restaurant or a hotel that's keeping the neighbourhood alive, actually, some of the rules don't really shift. And I think the Mitsotakis interview does tie in with some of the other hospitality things, because he's talking about how to make same-sex couples feel welcome in a country, how to help people put down roots and also appease people who are worried about migration. Also, it's a story about hospitality when you think about near neighbours.
Indeed, so.
You know, rumbling troubles in the Eastern Med, to the north of Greece as well, disagreements. How can you be a leader and show people that, you know, there are ways of compromising that don't make you look weak, which I think is very important. So that's the hospitality theme. The other theme is style. And doesn't that fit in well with Mr. Mitsotakis?
Are you saying it doesn't fit in well with the other person in that photograph? I was wearing a suit.
You were.
I made an effort.
You were wearing a suit, but somewhat unconvincingly, if I may be so bold. But you know, when we talk about style, it can seem like an ephemeral, a throwaway thing. Actually, it's kind of a bit of branding for certain people. And we do a story about hotel uniforms and how they can tell a story about service, even from the way that they're made, where they're manufactured. And we do a great story at the end of the issue. Obviously, there's reporting, there's affairs stories about the refueling of jets above the Nevada desert. But I really love this story at the end, which is a kind of visual exploration of restaurants. And so much of restaurant coverage is about novelty, about the must-see, must-try place. We actually went back to seven places that really haven't changed anything about what they've done. The first one here is the Kronenhalle. It celebrated its 100th anniversary. And it's a story about, in a world where things change so quickly, Monocle isn't afraid, I think, to step back and say, well, you know, why is it changing? Does it work? And there are stories about hospitality laced through the whole issue.
If it's not broken, don't fix it. I am a huge, huge fan of places like that, those ones where you feel like you're sort of stepping into history when you walk into that restaurant or that hotel. I mean, obviously, it's preferable if they have washed the tablecloths at some point in the last century. But yeah, I'm really, really fond of those places. And in fact, going back to Munich, we went back, me and Team Foreign Desk, to the same place we went last year, which was the Bavarian beer hall of your dreams, which we wandered into at random, and basically I don't think has changed much since it was built, which I like to think was some considerable time ago. But it was just with the big table down the middle and staff wearing lederhosen and Bavarian food served the way Bavarian food should be. It would have been a candidate for this spread, in fact.
Well, you know, some of these restaurants are amazing because I just opened a page at random. This is the Odeon in Tribeca, a kind of well-known restaurant that was taken over by some arts graduates in the 80s who had no experience of running a restaurant. The cafe had been there since the 30s. But in a funny neighbourhood where everything changed, which struggled after 9/11, and actually the cafe served the firefighters who were pulling people from the buildings, and it stayed open. It's a thing that's changed in a neighbourhood. And also, I think there's something interesting about these markers of cities that don't alter with time. And so much of journalism is about what's new and what's unusual. I think this is an interesting issue where you won't certainly have read any of the stories before, how to detox your children, the quirks of California's balloting for the election, Copenhagen's new parks, Lederhosen with oomph, as the cover says, which is a story about a tract fair in Salzburg. There is newness and novelty, but a great Monocle story, which I say to writers and which I say to anyone who'll listen, often has this element of not changing the things that don't need fixing.
Josh Fennett, thank you.
And thanks also to Andrew Muller there. If you are interested, and you should be, Monocle's April issue is out now. Its headline is a nice bright yellow, chic styles and warm smiles, the best spring looks and timeless hospitality. Well, that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to our producers, Christy O'Grady, Laura Kramer and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Lily Austin, with editing assistance from Sarah Nicol. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing's live at midday here in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.